Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and stories from around the world is designed for people learning English. So we speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. On the show today, we hear reports from Ashley Thompson and me. Later, Alice Bryant brings us Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with our program, American Stories. Today, we start Love of Life by Jack London. Now, here is Ashley Thompson.
The fight against poverty is getting help from faraway objects, satellites orbiting the Earth. Satellite images are helping researchers map areas of extreme poverty. Those pictures may help officials quickly identify when development policies and programs are working and when they are not. Ending extreme poverty by the year 2030 is the first of the United Nations' 17 Sustainable Development Goals. Experts usually measure poverty by using official census records and other studies. But population counts are costly, slow, and labor-intensive. Countries usually organize such studies once every several years. But satellites can map the Earth's surface with great detail every few days. The imagery is getting better and less costly as a growing number of public and private satellite systems go into service. Researchers have used the brightness of lights in nighttime images to estimate an area's economic activity. Others have used machine learning to identify richer and poorer villages from satellite imagery. One group used building density and vegetation cover to identify wealthy and poor neighborhoods. One new study has taken the most detailed look ever. Within a single village, it attempts to identify the poorest individual households. It was correct 62% of the time. The study involved the village of Sauri in rural Kenya. Sauri was part of the Millennium Villages Project, a poverty alleviation experiment that was launched in 2005. As part of the project, detailed information was collected on the earnings and valuables of each home in Sauri. In satellite images of the village, researchers measured the size of each house and studied the agricultural land surrounding it. Not surprisingly, smaller homes usually housed poorer people. But the researchers also noted other findings. For example, poorer homes often have bare farm fields in September. In rural Kenya, that usually means farmers are preparing their land for a second crop. Gary Watmo is a geographer at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland and the lead writer of a report on the study. Watmo notes that late-season rains do not always come to this part of Kenya. In fact, they fail to arrive up to half the time. Watmo added that late-season planting is done by poor people because it's a necessity. They either don't have enough land or they need to have that insurance just in case something else goes wrong, he said. Satellite imagery also found poorer households' fields were growing crops for shorter periods of time. They also were not planting their own crops as early as others. Watmo said, That was because they were contracting themselves out to plant other, wealthier households' crops first. The money they earned from such work went toward buying seeds. But that meant their own crops had less time to grow. The study demonstrates the possibilities for satellite data to distinguish between the wealth of you and your neighbor, said David Newhouse, an economist with the World Bank. He called such possibilities scary but also somewhat exciting. Newhouse was not involved with the study. The markers of poverty and Sauri will not be the same everywhere. The methods would need to be changed for other areas. Experts also say it is not the best idea to use only information from satellite images. The aid group GiveDirectly used satellite images to target donations to people in villages with a high number of thatched roofs on homes. These villages were considered poorer than those with metal on top. But people learned what was happening. So some claimed to live in thatched-roofed structures next to their metal-roofed homes so they could receive donations. GiveDirectly has since changed its methods. Damien Jacques is an expert in remote sensing, the use of satellites or high-flying aircraft to collect information about the Earth. He said there is power in combining satellite data and on-the-ground information. Jacques said, using the two types of data, one that is cheap to collect and very frequently available to complement traditional data that are expensive to collect and not frequent, you can get the best of the two. It is not known whether changes in poverty can be measured from space. That is something Watmo and other researchers will be investigating. They have survey records from Sauri from 2005 and 2008. The next step is to look for differences in the imagery. I'm Ashley Thompson.
When people use maps, they are usually seeking directions to a place they want to go. But Susan Shulton sees much more in maps, like history, culture, and art. She shares some of those findings in her book, A History of America in 100 Maps. Shulton travels back in time using maps of the past. Her book explores the hopes, dreams, and fears of ordinary people dating back to before the United States came to be. There is practically no area of American history where maps don't sort of enrich our understanding, Shulton said. Maps record past scenarios, past situations, past relationships of power, but they also influenced people at the time in terms of future decision-making. Shulton is a history professor at the University of Denver in Colorado. She studies cartography, the making of maps. During her research, she became very interested in a series of maps made by American schoolgirls in the early 1800s. The detailed maps appealed to her not only for their beauty, but also because of what they taught about a little-known period in American education. New schools educating young women for the first time outside the home prepared a curriculum that involved teaching them not just geography, but map drawing, she says. She says the girls studied technical methods of art, writing, and understanding geography by creating their own maps. The schools for girls were open for only a short time. Knowledge of them might have been lost if not for the maps they left behind. Shulton says those early maps also helped establish a national identity and loyalty for the United States in its early days. Shulton says that most American colonists were first loyal to their colony and then to the King of England. After independence, schools became a place to establish a shared meaning of the new country. There's such an emphasis after the Revolution on using education to help create a civic identity, and it becomes readily apparent, Shulton says. The book also includes some Native American maps. They help shape an understanding of how Natives saw power relationships. A 1721 map, most likely made by a Cherokee leader, includes a number of circles. The sizes of the circles are linked to the perceived power of the individual tribes. It's a representation of space from a non-European perspective, Shulton said. Some maps in the book recall dark moments in American history. An 1885 report on the Chinatown neighborhood in San Francisco, California, helps tell of the racism that Chinese laborers experienced. These immigrants had helped build the Transcontinental Railroad. After it was complete, many of the workers settled in San Francisco. A report commissioned by city supervisors described the Chinese in extremely offensive, race-based terms. A map made for the report shows opium places, gambling establishments, and houses where sex was sold in Chinatown. The message of the report and map was that the Chinese should be removed. From political moves like gerrymandering, to advertising, to red and blue states, maps tell many American stories. They can also be used to push reform and help to set the country on a new course. Shulton said there were maps used to support the anti-alcohol movement, the opposition to slavery, and the fight to gain voting rights for women. A History of America in 100 Maps includes maps never before published, Shulton said. Others are well known, but all can provide a special understanding of America's past.
In the English language, spelling and pronunciation have a funny relationship. How we write a word and how we say it often do not agree. There always seem to be exceptions to the rule. Today, our question is related to pronunciation. It comes from our reader, Mastane.
How can we recognize the syllables in a word? Would you mind explaining the rules? Thank you.
Hi, Mastane. Firstly, other readers may be wondering why they should learn about syllables. Understanding syllables helps a lot with pronunciation. As we speak, if we miss or add a syllable to a word, people may not be able to understand us. When we say a word, the sounds we create naturally divide the word into parts. We call these parts syllables. For example, the word machine has two parts, ma-sheen. The word important has three parts, im-por-tent. The number of syllables in a word is decided by its number of vowel sounds. For example, in the word machine, there are two vowel sounds, and e. The English language has up to 20 vowel sounds, so we will not talk about all of them today. But an easy way to identify vowels is that we make them with the letters A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y. It is important to know that one syllable can have more than one vowel letter. For example, the word room has two vowel letters, O and O, but together they make only one vowel sound, U. This explains why room has only one syllable. We decide syllables by sound, not spelling. Okay, here are two easy methods for counting syllables. One that I like is the chin method. Here is how to do it. Rest your hand under your chin and say a word slowly. How many times does your chin drop onto your hand? That is the number of syllables. Another is the clap method. To use it, say the word and clap your hands together each time you hear a vowel sound. For example, take the word autumn. Autumn. That's two vowel sounds, so it's two syllables. Even though autumn has three vowel letters, A, U, and U. Now, let's do something fun. Close your eyes and listen for the number of syllables in the following words. You can use the chin method, the clap method, or just listen carefully. Flower, thought, teacher, broadcast, dreamed, vehicle. How many syllables did you get for each word? You can tell us in the comments area. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 1.
The two men moved painfully down the bank and fell among the rocks that were scattered everywhere. They were tired and weak. Their faces showed the patient appearance that results from difficulty long endured. They were heavily burdened with blanket packs which were tied to their shoulders. Each man carried a gun. They walked in a leaning position, the shoulders forward, the head farther forward, the eyes fixed upon the ground.
"I wish we had a couple of those cartridges that are lying in our cache," said the second man. His voice was completely without expression. And the first man, walking into the milky stream that flowed over the rocks, made no reply. The other man followed at his heels. They did not remove their shoes, although the water was icy cold. It was so cold that their feet soon were without feeling. In places the water dashed against their knees, and both men found it difficult to remain standing. The man who followed slipped upon a smooth rock and nearly fell. He recovered his footing with great effort, at the same time uttering a sharp cry of pain. He seemed faint and stretched one hand forward, seeking support against the air. When he had steadied himself, he stepped forward, but he slipped again and nearly fell. Then he stood still
and looked at the other man, who had never turned his head. The man stood still for fully a minute, as if he were deciding something. Then he called out,
I say, Bill, I hurt my foot.
Bill struggled ahead through the milky water. He did not look around. The man watched him go, and although his face lacked expression as before, his eyes had the look of a wounded animal. The other man climbed the farther bank of the stream and continued straight ahead, without looking back. The man in the stream watched him. His lips trembled a little.
Bill!
He cried. It was the despairing cry of a strong man in trouble, but Bill's head did not turn. The man watched him go, struggling forward up the hill toward the skyline. He watched him go until he passed over the hilltop and disappeared. Then he turned his gaze and slowly examined the circle of the world that remained to him, now that Bill was gone. The sun was low in the sky, almost hidden by a cover of clouds. The man looked at his watch while supporting his weight on one leg. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The season was near the end of July or the 1st of August. He did not know the exact date within a week or two, but that was enough to know that the sun marked the northwest. He looked to the south and decided that somewhere beyond those hills lay the Great Bear Lake. Also, he knew that behind the same hills, the Arctic Circle cut its way across the plains of northern Canada, called the Barrens. This stream in which he stood flowed into the Coppermine River, which in turn flowed north and emptied into the Arctic Ocean. He had never been there, but he had seen it once on a map. Again, his gaze completed the circle of the world about him. It was not a cheerful sight. Everywhere was soft skyline. The hills were all low-lying. There were no trees, no grasses. There was nothing but a vast emptiness that brought fear into his eyes.
Bill!
He whispered once and twice.
Bill!
He stood trembling in the milky water, feeling the vastness pressing in upon him with great force. He began to shake as with a disease, until the gun falling from his hand into the stream brought him back to reality. He fought with his fear and regained his self-control. He recovered the gun from the water. He pushed his pack more toward his left shoulder. This helped to take a portion of its weight off the foot he had hurt. Then he proceeded slowly and carefully, in great pain, to the bank of the stream. He did not stop, with a worry that was madness, unmindful of the pain. He hurried up the hill to the top over which his companion had disappeared. But at the top he saw a valley empty of life. He fought with his fear again and won. Then once more he moved the pack farther toward his left shoulder and struggled down the hill. The bottom of the valley was very wet. Thick plant life held the moisture close to the surface, and the water flowed from under his feet at every step. He picked his way carefully across the valley and followed the other man's footsteps along the rocks, which made small islands in the sea of wet plant life. Although alone, he was not lost. Farther on, he knew, he would come to where dead pine trees bordered the shore of a little lake. In the language of that country, it was called the Land of Little Sticks. Into that lake flowed a small stream, the water of which was not milky. There was grass along that stream, but no trees. He would follow the stream until it divided. He would cross this place of dividing to another stream, flowing to the west. This he would follow until it emptied into the River Dease. Here he would find a cache under an upturned boat covered with many rocks. In this cache there would be cartridges for his empty gun, and fish hooks and lines. Everything he needed for catching food would be there. Also he would find flour, a little meat, and some beans. Bill would be waiting for him there, and they would find a boat and row south down the Dease to the Great Bear Lake. And south across the lake they would go, ever south, until they came to the Mackenzie River. And south, always south they would go, while the winter raced after them, and the ice formed in the streams, and the days grew cold. South they would go, to some warm place where the trees grew tall and full, and there was food without end. These were the thoughts of the man as he struggled forward, but as strongly as he struggled with his body, he struggled equally with his mind. He tried to believe that Bill had not deserted him. Surely Bill would wait for him at the cache. He was forced to think this thought, otherwise there would not be any reason to continue, and he would lie down and die. As the ball of the sun sank slowly into the northwest, he recalled every inch of his and Bill's flight south ahead of the oncoming winter, and he thought again and again of the food in the cache. It had been 2 days since he had anything to eat. It was a far longer time since he had had enough to eat. Often he picked muskeg berries, put them into his mouth, and ate them. A muskeg berry is a small seed in a drop of water. In the mouth, the water melts away and the seed tastes bitter. The man knew there was no real food value in the berries, but he ate them, patiently, with a hope greater than his experience. At 9 o'clock that night, he hit his toe on a rocky surface, and from weakness and tiredness, he fell to the ground. He lay for some time without movement on his side. He took his pack from his back and dragged himself into a sitting position. It was not yet dark. While some light remained, he felt among the rocks for pieces of dried plants. When he had gathered a pile, he built a fire and put a tin pot of water on it to boil. He unwrapped his pack. The first thing he did was to count his matches. There were 67. He counted them 3 times to be sure. He divided them into several portions, wrapping them in paper. He put one portion in his empty tobacco pack, another in the inside band of his hat, and a third under his shirt against his flesh. This accomplished, he began to worry whether he had counted correctly. He unwrapped them all and counted them again. Yes, there were 67. He dried his wet shoes and socks by the fire. The moccasins were badly torn. His socks were worn through in places, and his feet were bleeding. The area between his foot and leg, the ankle, was very painful. He examined it. It had swelled until it was as large as his knee. He cut a long strip from one of his 2 blankets and bound the ankle tightly. He cut other strips and bound them about his feet to serve both for moccasins and socks. Then he drank the pot of hot water, wound his watch, and pulled his blankets around him. He slept like a dead man. The brief darkness at midnight came and went. Then the sun rose in the northeast. It can be better said that day dawned in that quarter of the sky because the sun was hidden by gray clouds. At 6 o'clock in the morning, he waked, quietly, lying on his back. He gazed straight up into the gray sky and knew that he was hungry. As he lifted himself on his elbow, he was frightened by a loud noise. There was a caribou looking at him curiously. The animal was not more than 50 feet away. And instantly into the man's mind came the picture of caribou meat cooking over a fire. From habit, he reached for the empty gun and aimed it. The caribou leaped away and disappeared across the rocks.
And that's our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.
This is